Mr. Tambourine Man. Andy Lack's first annual meeting at Sony was in April 2003, the same week that Apple launched the iTunes Store. He had been made head of the music division 4 months earlier and had spent much of that time negotiating with Jobs. In fact, he arrived in Tokyo directly from Cupertino, carrying the latest version of the iPod and a description of the iTunes Store. In front of 200 managers gathered, he pulled the iPod out of his pocket. "Here it is," he said, as CEO Nobuyuki Ide and Sony's North America head, Howard Stringer, looked on. "Here's the Walkman killer. There's no mystery meat. The reason you bought a music company is so that you could be the one to make a device like this. You can do better." But Sony couldn't. It had pioneered portable music with the Walkman, it had a great record company, and it had a long history of making beautiful consumer devices. It had all of the assets to compete with Jobs' strategy of integration of hardware, software, devices, and content sales. Why did it fail? Partly because it was a company, like AOL Time Warner, that was organized into divisions. That word itself was ominous, with their own bottom lines. The goal of achieving synergy in such companies by prodding the divisions to work together was usually elusive. Jobs did not organize Apple into semi-autonomous divisions. He closely controlled all of his teams and pushed them to work as one cohesive and flexible company, with one profit and loss bottom line. "We don't have divisions with their own P&L," said Tim Cook. "We run one P&L for the company." In addition, like many companies, Sony worried about cannibalization. If it built a music player and service that made it easy for people to share digital songs, that might hurt sales of its record division. One of Jobs's business rules was to never be afraid of cannibalizing yourself. "If you don't cannibalize yourself, someone else will," he said. So even though an iPhone might cannibalize sales of an iPod, or an iPad might cannibalize sales of a laptop, that did not deter him. That July, Sony appointed a veteran of the music industry, Jay Samet, to create its own iTunes-like service called Sony Connect, which would sell songs online and allow them to play on Sony's portable music devices. The move was immediately understood as a way to unite the sometimes conflicting electronics and content divisions, the New York Times reported. That internal battle was seen by many as the reason Sony, the inventor of the Walkman and the biggest player in the portable audio market, was being trounced by Apple. Sony Connect launched in May 2004. It lasted just over 3 years before Sony shut it down. Microsoft was willing to license its Windows Media Software and digital rights format to other companies, just as it had licensed out its operating system in the 1980s. Jobs, on the other hand, would not license out Apple's FairPlay to other device makers. It worked only on an iPod. Nor would he allow other online stores to sell songs for use on iPods. A variety of experts said this would eventually cause Apple to lose market share, as it did in the computer wars of the 1980s. If Apple continues to rely on a proprietary architecture, the Harvard Business School professor Clayton Christensen told Wired, the iPod will likely become a niche product. Other than in this case, Christensen was one of the world's most insightful business analysts, and Jobs was deeply influenced by his book, The Innovator's Dilemma. Bill Gates made the same argument. "There's nothing unique about music," he said. "This story has played out on the PC." Rob Glaser, the founder of Real Networks, tried to circumvent Apple's restrictions in July 2004 with a service called Harmony. He had attempted to convince Jobs to license Apple's FairPlay format to Harmony, But when that didn't happen, Glazer just reverse-engineered it and used it with the songs that Harmony sold. Glazer's strategy was that the songs sold by Harmony would play on any device, including an iPod or a Zune or a Rio, and he launched a marketing campaign with the slogan, Freedom of Choice. Jobs was furious and issued a release saying that Apple was stunned that Real Networks has adopted the tactics and ethics of a hacker to break into the iPod. Real Networks responded by launching an internet petition that demanded, "Hey, Apple, don't break my iPod." Jobs kept quiet for a few months, but in October, he released a new version of the iPod software that caused songs bought through Harmony to become inoperable. "Steve is a one-of-a-kind guy," Glazer said. "You know that about him when you do business with him." In the meantime, Jobs and his team, Rubenstein, Fidel, Robin, Ive, were able to keep coming up with new versions of the iPod that extended Apple's lead. The first major revision, announced in January 2004, was the iPod Mini, far smaller than the original iPod, just the size of a business card. It had less capacity and was about the same price. At one point, Jobs decided to kill it, not seeing why anyone would want to pay the same for less. He doesn't do sports, so he didn't relate to how it would be great on a run or in the gym, said Fidel. In fact, the Mini was what truly launched the iPod to market dominance by eliminating the competition from smaller flash drive players. In the 18 months after it was introduced, Apple's market share in the portable music player market shot from 31% to 74%. The iPod Shuffle, introduced in January 2005, was even more revolutionary. Jobs learned that the Shuffle feature on the iPod, which played songs in random order, had become very popular. People liked to be surprised, and they were also too lazy to keep setting up and revising their playlists. Some users even became obsessed with figuring out whether the song selection was truly random, and if so, why their iPod kept coming back to, say, the Neville Brothers. That feature led to the iPod Shuffle. As Rubenstein and Fidel were working on creating a flash player that was small and inexpensive, they kept doing things like making the screen tinier. At one point, Jobs came in with a crazy suggestion. "Get rid of the screen altogether." "What?" Fidel responded. "Just get rid of it," Jobs insisted. Fidel asked how users would navigate the songs. Jobs's insight was that you wouldn't need to navigate. The songs would play randomly. After all, they were songs you had chosen. All that was needed was a button to skip over a song if you weren't in the mood for it. "Embrace uncertainty," the ads read. As competitors stumbled and Apple continued to innovate, music became a larger part of Apple's business. In January 2007, iPod sales were half of Apple's revenues. The device also added luster to the Apple brand. But an even bigger success was the iTunes Store. Having sold 1 million songs in the first 6 days after it was introduced in April 2003, the store went on to sell 70 million songs in its first year. In February 2006, the store sold its 1 billionth song when Alex Ostrovsky, 16, of West Bloomfield, Michigan, bought Coldplay's Speed of Sound and got a congratulatory call from Jobs, bestowing upon him 10 iPods, an iMac, and a $10,000 music gift certificate. The success of the iTunes Store also had a more subtle benefit. By 2011, an important new business had emerged, being the service that people trusted with their online identity and payment information. Along with Amazon, Visa, PayPal, American Express, and a few other services, Apple had built up databases of people who trusted them with their email address and credit card information to facilitate safe and easy shopping. This allowed Apple to sell, for example, a magazine subscription through its online store. When that happened, Apple, not the magazine publisher, would have a direct relationship with the subscriber. As the iTunes Store sold videos, apps, and subscriptions, it built up a database of 225 million active users by June 2011, which positioned Apple for the next stage of digital commerce.